Welcome to WITCAST, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network, an international organization that contributes to the empowerment of women and seeks to address a gender gap that still exists in Brazil and in the world when it comes to international trade. Hello, in this special episode to discuss the outcomes of the Ministerial Conference number 12 of the WTO, we are going to understand a little bit of the outcomes of the Fishery Subsidies Agreement. And we are going to talk about this issue with Beatriz Stevens. Beatriz Stevens is Senior Trade Policy Attaché at the UK Mission to the WTO in Geneva, covering a range of files, including the fisheries negotiations at the WTO. Prior to that, Beatriz also worked as a trade advisor for the Commonwealth Small State Offices in Geneva, providing technical assistance and capacity building on selected WTO issues, and as a trade specialist at the Brazilian Mission to the WTO. She is also the Women Inside Trade representative in Geneva. She holds an LLM in Business and Corporate Law from the University of San Diego in California, and a master's degree in International Economic Law from the University of Paris Sorbonne. So today we have another episode to discuss a little bit of the results and outcomes of the Ministerial Conference of the WTO 12. And today we're going to talk about the Fisheries Subsidies Agreement. And we invited Beatriz Stevens to talk a little bit about this subject. Beatriz is Senior Trade Policy Attaché at the UK Mission to the WTO and other organizations in Geneva. Beatriz, thank you so much for talking to us.
Hi, both. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
So Carolina Matos and I are here today to discuss a little bit on the Fishery Subsidies Agreement. And I'm going to begin with a context question to you. We know that this was one of the outcomes of the Ministerial Conference is this Fishery Subsidies Agreement. It's the first agreement that deals directly with environment. We know from recent FAO data that fish stocks are being exploited in levels that are next to collapse from overfishing. We know also that fishing activity has been impacting marine environments that go beyond fish stocks, but creates a series of other consequences. And the recent Global Oceans Conference in Lisbon highlighted the urgency to address some of these issues and to the importance of international collaboration in oceans management. So with this context in mind, Beatriz, how do you place the fisheries agreement and how to assess its relevance?
Well, the fisheries agreement is really an important achievement, a historical achievement, as you mentioned, from MC12 as part of this overall Geneva package of outcomes. It's really the result of almost 20 plus years of really complex, really highly technical negotiations. And as you mentioned, it's a first for the WTO in addressing really sustainability at its core. And most of you have been following that environment is increasingly becoming part of the agenda of the multilateral trading system. So we really need to welcome this as a positive step in the right direction. So the agreement, just I guess a note of clarification, it creates disciplines for subsidies applicable to the fishing sector. So that's a little bit the hook to the WTO, apologies for the pun, but what we do have is a set of binding and multilateral rules for all WTO members that they have to abide to when they design or implement subsidies programs for their fishery sectors. So it really, like I said, it's a long negotiation, but it got a renewed impetus after SDG 14.6. We had missed deadlines already, so it was really, really critical, really important that we were able to secure a multilateral outcome at this ministerial. And I think it's even more important, you mentioned on the context, it really does raise the awareness on this issue. It creates a bit more of a momentum on, you know, how serious the issue of declining fish stocks is and how important it is for members to renew their efforts and collaborate together in trying to improve global oceans governance. So I guess it's important not only from this substantive thematic aspect of really bringing environmental and sustainability concerns into the WTO as part of a multilateral agreement. It's also very important for the organization itself. We have shown that when there's a willingness to negotiate, members can get together in a negotiating mode and deliver some outcomes, even if this specific agreement is a bit less ambitious than what most members were expecting. So it does fall short in some regards from what we were expecting as a result, but it's much better to have an imperfect agreement than to have no agreement at all. And this, as you pointed out, also we had the Global Oceans Conference recently, which was held in Lisbon, and there was a lot of awareness about this agreement and a lot of discussions around how important this is going to be for global oceans governance in general. So it was actually very timely that we got the fishery subsidies agreement a little bit before that international event. So it does provide, we feel, a bit more of an impetus on improving the mechanisms that we have nowadays on strengthening sustainability around ocean resources.
Thank you, Beatriz. And I think it would be interesting to get into the specifics of the agreement. Can you describe a little bit and explain how the agreement is structured and in terms of concepts and so on? I think that would be very interesting for our listeners.
So if we are to look a bit more in detail into the specific disciplines of the agreement, this is at the outset, I think it's important for us to note, this is the first agreement with environmental sustainability at its core, and this is obviously a real landmark for the work of the organization and the work going forward. So the agreement itself is structured around 12 articles. And three, I'd say, sort of core disciplines on subsidies targeted to the fishery sector. So the first article, Article 1, is contains the scope part of the agreement, and here we have the same definition taken from the Agreement on Subsidies and Countervailing Measures, the ASCM. So Article 1 is referring to that same discipline of subsidies applicable to wild marine capture fishing and fishing-related activities. So just important to note that the agreement is not extended to aquaculture and inland fisheries, and there's a specific carve-out as well for payments under government-to-government access agreements that is included in the scope-setting discipline of the agreement. So because we have that definition of subsidy taken from the other agreement, the ASCM, this is important insofar as when we reach Article 8 on notification requirements, members are already required to make regular notifications under their subsidies. So we now have also notification requirements applicable to subsidies granted to the fishery sectors, which is a key element, key portion of this recent agreement. So it strengthens transparency. It allows members to have more information, more transparency about these measures. And as I mentioned, if members are already required to notify subsidies every 30th of June on a regular basis under this new agreement. So with these new notification obligations, we'll have access to information such as stock status, conservation measures being taken by members, or catch data and findings of, for instance, vessels that are engaged in IUU fishing. So a series of informations that are now part of the regular notification process of WTO committee, a WTO committee that will have to be set up, and will enable us to monitor closely the implementation and effectiveness of this agreement. So that's Article 8. not dealing so much with the institutional part of the agreement, but if we move to the more substantive, the core disciplines of the agreement, members have agreed to three core disciplines, three pillars, if we can call it like that. One of them being a prohibition against subsidies to IUU fishing, illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, on Article 3. And that's, we've taken that definition from another international legal framework, the International Plan of Action to Prevent, Deter, and Eliminate IUU Fishing, from the FAO. So that is the definition the members are working with. And the operation of that discipline is that you don't have, members don't have an obligation to make a finding that IUU is taking place, but the prohibition is triggered once such a determination occurs. So you have either a coastal state or a regional fisheries management organization, what we call RFMO or RFMAs, which then are entitled to make a finding that IUU is taking place, and then that triggers the prohibition of that particular vessel from receiving subsidies. And this is really key, really crucial, because it means that those vessels, those operators would then be listed as ineligible for obtaining subsidies for fishing activity, which is very important for us to tackle such an important issue such as IUU fishing. And then there's a series of procedural requirements that have to take place as well, for that determination to take place, just to ensure that because it involves a national process as well, right? A coastal state is the one that can make the determination of IUU fishing. So there's a bit of some how can I say this? Procedural safeguards to make sure of some elements are observed for that prohibition to be triggered. That is all encompassed in Article 3. Article 4, we've agreed to a prohibition against subsidies on stocks that are overfished. And this is also very important because we're talking about the stocks that are in the most serious and dire condition. So they are particularly fragile. And this condition of being overfished is something that has to be established by, again, either the coastal state or an RFMO, Regional Fisheries Management Organization, which is, they take these powers that they have already from established instruments of international law. So in the exercise of this right, they determine that a particular stock is overfished, and then subsidies to those stocks are prohibited, and it's an important pillar. It has a caveat that if there are measures that are in place relating to that stock that are aimed at rebuilding that stock and on making sure it recovers to healthy levels, then that prohibition no longer applies. But that has to be demonstrated. So again, you have a prohibition that is triggered by a particular circumstance or a characteristic of the stock, but with the possibility of, for instance, members that want to reinstore the health of that stock, they are under the current discipline, they are allowed to adopt subsidies for that purpose, for that specific purpose, and then that's the sort of overfished stocks. And then under Article 5, we have the prohibition against subsidies for areas outside members' jurisdiction, so areas unregulated waters, which, again, given the fact that they are in the high seas, so there's a little to no control on these areas, there's a heightened risk that fishing in those areas can be a bit more problematic, considering if it's taking place outside control of RFMOs or coastal states. So that is also a key prohibition that we had in the agreement. So taken together, these three core disciplines are what the agreement disciplines at this stage. We as mentioned, the level of ambition is lower than when we had started negotiating the agreement, but it's still a very good outcome. It's a strong agreement with strong rules and strong monitoring mechanisms as well, and a mandate to continue negotiating a set of comprehensive rules, given that the pillar on overfishing and overcapacity, subsidies that leads to overfishing and overcapacity, were left out of the agreement. But it's still a very, very important milestone in addressing the health of ocean resources and trying to revert the very worrying trend of declining fish stocks. So we do think this is a really important, really significant landmark agreement, which doesn't mean the work ends there. We must continue working to finalize negotiations and now more urgently work towards implementation as quickly as possible. So the focus now has shifted to ensuring we have speedy ratification by members who have to undergo internal national procedures to get the agreement ratified, depositing a letter of an instrument of acceptance with the WTO. And when 2/3 of the membership perform that, then the agreement can enter into force. And given that we still have elements to negotiate, and given the status of oceans fishery resources, it's important that members collectively work as seamlessly and collaboratively as possible to ensure we get this fast on track as soon as possible, and can get the agreement to enter into force. So Article 7 of the agreement also envisages the creation of a dedicated fund, the fisheries funding mechanism, which will see technical assistance and capacity building available to eligible developing and least developed countries to implement the agreements, and is specifically also notes the important institutional collaboration with other organizations that work with fisheries related conservation and organizations such as the FAO and the World Bank, to ensure that some of these disciplines will require internal policy change, revisiting national subsidy programs, and beyond just the compliance with the provisions of the agreement, there will also probably need assistance in strengthening their fisheries management regimes, having a robust set of rules that are able to have a stronger management and conservation oriented structure. So this technical assistance and capacity building aspect of the agreement is also extremely relevant, and the fund is still some funding has been committed already. It's still the details of how it will operate are still being finalized. But yeah, together with the creation of a fisheries committee, as foreseen in Article 9, there's still these other elements that are that will see the light of day in the very near future, hopefully. It's interesting to see in this agreement that we've incorporated definitions and legal concepts taken from other international instruments, such be it the UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or FAO's plans of action. So we're working, we're not reinventing the wheel, but working with these concepts that are already in existence, and it's facilitates the understanding of the rules. And I guess a last comment, just to say the importance of this agreement in terms of showing that members are able to agree multilaterally on rules that are for the public common good, and it's a good message from the organization, from the WTO as well, on renewed importance and focus on international governments, governance systems and structures in addressing these societal urgent matters, such as the state of Boshan's fish stocks, and it's a good positive outcome for us and for generations to come.
Thank you, Beatrice. And it's a new topic to WTO. And in practice, what are some of the measures that members will have to implement?
So this agreement is it creates rules around pillars, namely the IUU and the overfish stocks pillars. What we had before was a draft agreement. I don't want to get too much into detail, but just to give a bit of an overview on the structure of the agreement. We had a draft agreement that had was composed of three pillars, one relating to IUU, which stands for illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, one on subsidies contributing to OCOF, overfishing and overcapacity, and one on overfish stocks. So what we have now with this agreement is rules that prohibit subsidies to be granted for vessels or operators that are found to be practicing IUU. So it goes a long way in protecting ocean resources in that regard. We also have a prohibition of subsidies to stocks when they are in overfish condition, or a requirement that at least governments put in place fishery management programs that ensures the stocks are able to rebuild to a biologically sustainable level. So what we have really is a set of rules targeting how subsidies are to be designed. So it will require from governments, having to think critically about how they manage their fishery subsidies programs. And the other pillar that I mentioned, the OCOF pillar, this was something that was built in. What we have in this agreement is a sort of embedded agenda to continue to negotiating on the other aspects of the agreement. And we have a deadline of 4 years to reach a more comprehensive set of rules. So as I mentioned at first, the agreement is not the level of ambition that all members wanted, but we made sure that we had this sort of hook to continue to negotiate these other elements of the agreement, so that hopefully by MC13 we have new rules, new disciplines on subsidies contributing to overfishing and overcapacity. And I think one element which is also important as this agreement is that it creates transparency obligations, which anything that helps enhance transparency is important in the WTO. It's important in this house. It allows members to learn and understand a bit more about each member's practices. So the rules around transparency are also an important element, and we will have more ways to follow up on what are the subsidies being practiced globally.
Okay, and what about next steps in this file? What will success for this agreement look like in the short and medium term?
I think now the most urgent and critical issue at hand is really to ensure we have a speedy ratification of this agreement. Some will remember that between the conclusion of the trade facilitation agreement in Bali and its entry into force, we had about 4 years period. You do have this requirement of 2/3 of the membership having to ratify the agreement before it enters into force. But of course, given the nature of this agreement, we shouldn't we don't want to have a too delayed entry into force, given this, the nature and the subject of this agreement, right? If we want to attain the sustainability objectives behind it, if we really want to protect fish stocks, we need to make sure members go through their internal ratification processes as soon as we're able to, just to ensure that we can get an entry into force as fast as possible. Not only because of that, but also given this this sort of sunset clause that's built into the agreement, right? We have a commitment to agree other sets of rules by a specified deadline. So we can't have a two delay period between once this agreement enters into force and when we finalize negotiations on the other outstanding elements. So I guess the real immediate aftermath of the agreement is just to push for ratification. We have good momentum, we have good, you know, stakeholder engagement and civil society and this ability that we got to get an agreement means that as soon as members are able to, we have to push forward for ratification and I guess start the work on negotiations as well, because time flies when you're negotiating and we hope obviously don't want to spend another 20 years negotiating. We got really, really good progress on MC12. So we want to keep that momentum and that agenda flying high here in Geneva.
Beatriz, thanks. That was good to have an overview of the agreement and the outcomes that we're expecting and the challenges when bringing the agreement to ratification. I think to wrap up, it would be interesting to understand from your personal view, how was the negotiations? What are your personal reflections on the days you spent at the MC12?
It was personally a very, very interesting, albeit challenging process, because the whole ministerial was very long and negotiations ran late into the night. So everything was really, really complex, but it was also, it was interesting to see, you know, we work with international trade. It means we work with people, right? It's a humans led, job. I mean, speaking personally from my personal perspective, you really do see the role of personalities and how interesting it is to get, you know, negotiators are, at the end of the day, we're all humans, right? So there's a lot of a human facet to working with negotiations. And I think I must comment on the work of the chair. He was very, very, very able in conducting these negotiations. I think he tried to keep the momentum and the pressure on members to reach an agreement, to conclude an agreement. So he really demonstrated a capacity to lead and to really exercise his chairmanship on a very, very, very efficient way, I would say. And I guess as well, for someone who's been in Geneva for 7 years now, it's this ministerial. You could definitely see more women participating. It's the first minister I participate in person, but you had a lot of women acting as chairs. You had a lot of women professional working with acting as facilitators of some of the discussions. A lot of more women ambassadors were present as well. A lot of women negotiators. So, of course, it's an agenda that's important, but it was in the DG as well, of course, being a woman herself, it was a good opportunity to see, you know, more women participating in global policy making in international trade. The DDGs were also very active. We had DDG alerts and the fisheries files. So yeah, I guess just my personal perspective of seeing, you know, more women here participating in these events is something that's very, very positive and definitely a trend that we should support and we welcome.
So Beatriz, thank you so much for all the information you talked to us today. It was a pleasure to have you here at WITCAST.
Thank you so much, and my pleasure, and looking forward to continue following the work of the network.
This was WITCAST, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network. I hope you enjoyed our talk and keep following us at www.womeninsidetrade.com.